Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. What happens when one of the most evil men in the history of America meets a man he trusts to share his darkest secrets with? How does it affect someone already on the edge of society when he is taken under the wing of a serial killer? Partly told through the letters of Arthur Shawcross, the Shawcross Letters is the tale of one of America's most notorious serial killers and his relationship with his would-be biographer, John Paul Fay. John Paul Fay was a murderabilia dealer with a troubled past. Arthur Shawcross, also known as the Genesee River Killer, was in prison after being convicted of murdering numerous women. He officially has killed 14 people in total. The two created a business relationship, with Fay shopping the drawings of Shawcross and working with him on a book of his life. They also created a bizarre friendship in which Shawcross would let out his darkest secrets and Fay would finally meet someone that he himself felt oddly at home with. But as we all know, be careful what you wish for you might just get it. The Shawcross Letters is a unique book. It is not only literary, but it lets the reader into the mind of a serial killer in a way that few books have ever done before. The reader will be drawn into the mind of Shawcross through his letters and will find themselves wondering what actually separates a serial killer from someone that walks among us every day. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Shawcross Letters, My Journey into the Mind of Evil, with my special guests, author John Paul Fay and journalist and author Brian Whitney. Welcome to the program, gentlemen, John Paul Fay and Brian Whitney.
Thanks, Dan.
Hello, good evening. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Again, very unique book, and I have some questions for you. So Let's first off, for those that may not know, I'm just going to briefly talk about Arthur Shawcross and his crimes before we get into this book, and I ask your backgrounds and reasons for you to write this book. Not everyone knows this is the Genesee River Killer. This was his, also known as 12 women upstate New York in 1988 to 1990. In 1972, he confessed to the sexual assault and murder of two children. But what he had was that he was convicted of the one, given manslaughter and 25 years in prison, and he was paroled after 15 years. In 1987, he was released on parole. In 1988, his killing spree occurred. 11 murders ensued of prostitutes after that, and arrested nearly 2 years later in custody, confessed. Then we have some other events where up to 2003, an interview where he made claims about cannibalism and other behavior that was not well known, was not known beforehand. Now, he died in 2008. He died in prison. So maybe the first question for you, John, is give us a little bit of your background. We talked about you being a murderabilia dealer. Tell us what that is and what that entails and why. Give us a little bit about your background and why you wanted to write this book. And first, how you came to want to have a relationship, a correspondence with Arthur Shawcross.
All right. Well, first of all, I've been a writer all my life, but also I'm pretty diverse. And back when you could still sell serial killer memorabilia, a.k.a. murderabilia, on eBay, I got into that. I kind of stumbled into that business, and I met a couple of his groupies actually online. We made a couple of trades, and they had some of his artwork, and so I ended up with it, and I decided to resell it on eBay, and so it kind of went on from there. But basically, Shawcross ended up writing to me, you know, and we ended up coming up with this business arrangement where he would do more drawings, and we'd more or less split the profits 50-50. That being said, I mean, as far as why I wrote this or what led me to write this, you know, it's really something I had to get out of my system, truth be told. I'm a very haunted mind, you know. So it is a literary exorcism. I'm just trying to work out some demons, more or less. So normally I'm a fiction writer. I've written horror and science fiction, that type of deal. But I had to reinvent myself for this, but it's more therapeutic than anything else. And I had a sister that kind of pushed me along too, assuring me that there was a story behind this. And it almost wrote itself, as some writers say. You know, you don't know if you're channeling something or whatever it may be, but it was more a form of therapy for me. And I don't know if I'm answering all of it.
How did Arthur Shawcross know of you, and why did he approach you? What we talked about the deal, but let's talk about why he would approach you and how he came to know who you were.
Because again, he's connected to certain groupies, and they pass out to other people's addresses, and you know, he was very curious as to who was making money from what he was doing.
Right.
And so he ended up with my name and address from somebody that I had been doing business with. And so one day in the sometime the summer of 2000. I got a letter from the Sullivan Correctional Facility, Arthur Shawcross, and that was our first contact. But yeah, he got my name and address from somebody else, so he actually initiated the contact, the correspondence, believe it or not.
Right.
You know.
Now,
so,
Brian, sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm just going to say, I don't know if that answered all the questions you had been posing to me.
Certainly.
I'm not sure. Okay.
Certainly.
All right.
Now, Brian, we had you on recently with another incredible story that, coincidentally or not, involved cannibalism as well, with The Cannibal
Right.
Cop, and your involvement with that book as well. Now, this says that the author is John Paul Fay with Brian Whitney. Tell us your real involvement, actual involvement in this book. What's your role, and also how you came to want to be interested and were in a position to be involved in the writing of this book?
Yeah, sure. We actually were put together because I wrote the book with Gil Valley, who was well known as the Cannibal Cop, a book called Raw Deal. It was published by Wild Blue. I had a good relationship with Wild Blue and Steve Jackson, who is an author and one of their owners, told me they were approached. I believe John approached them first, by John, about this book, and he connected me with John, and my role basically was just, John, this is John's baby, and John did an amazing, amazing job with it.
Thank you.
I thought I was going to be doing much more than I actually ended up doing, because John just, no pun intended, he just killed it. But I've always been really fascinated by subcultures, and I like writing about things and working with people that most people find a little bit too dark to touch. So I just was approached by Steve, and I worked with John on the book, and it went very smoothly right off the bat. And I think that's basically the answer to what you asked me.
You talk about in the introduction, so maybe I can ask you, because I think both of your behalfs, about this book not intended to glorify Arthur Shawcross's actions. So this book is much different than, say, what people might imagine. Tell us a little bit about what you really have intended to do with this book and what it really does in that unique way provide.
This is
where
for
other
me.
Books...
And this is for me.
Yes,
yeah. So no, I mean, I personally, I mean, I'm a true crime fan, obviously. I've read a lot of true crime, but it's not the point's not to glorify Shawcross. It's filled with his letters. They're very brutal, they're misogynistic, they're horrible. To me, the main point of the book, what fascinates me about the book is that, you know, there are all sorts of people in the world that have dark thoughts, dark fantasies. Some of them act on them, some of them don't, which again is sort of similar to the cannibal cop aspect of what I already spoke to. And this book is written by John, who's a man that had a difficult childhood, that has a lot of fantasies and desires that people would consider odd and dark. And he hasn't acted on them. And then you have another man who had very similar fantasies, who acted on them in the worst possible way. And that to me it's not about at all glorifying people that do dark things. It's more about questioning what we do as a society when we come across people of this nature, and, you know, the fear that you might feel when you realize somebody might have a dark thought or feeling or urge, and why you feel that fear and why you can't like reach out to that person anyway and sort of try to be, try to be more open to people that are different, that haven't done awful things like Shawcross did. If you know what I'm trying to say. Shawcross did horrible things, and it's a good thing he was locked up before he did more horrible things. But I find fascinating the way we look as a society and as a culture, just how we deal with people that are different in almost any way. So that to me is the larger overreaching aspect of this book. And I think John was incredibly brave to write it. And I think it's a really cool book.
Let's get to John. When we talk about, I mentioned some of the things that Shawcross was convicted for, but I alluded to a 2003, he was interviewed by a British reporter, Catherine English, for a documentary on cannibalism.
Oh, right.
At that time, he bragged about slicing out and eating vaginas of three of the victims and also eating the genitals of the boy he was convicted of killing in 1972. Some criminologists have doubted those stories. Now, there was also the 1992 book. Joel Norris wrote a book, paperback. This paperback book came with a cassette tape or a tape that was reported to be the live confessions of Arthur Shawcross and his hideous crimes. Before you got into this, before you became, obviously, we're all talking about true crime fans here, the audience, Brian, myself, and you. We're all true crime fans of varying degrees and seriousness. What did you know officially about Shawcross? How interested were you in Arthur Shawcross specifically? And what did you know? What did you do as a result of this correspondence? How much did you know beforehand? How much did you believe, like if criminologists have doubted some of these stories about cannibalism, what did you believe? Tell us a little bit about what you knew and what you knew about Arthur Shawcross from the beginning.
Right. Well, I think I've read most of the books about him beforehand, just, again, like I say, as a true crime fan. I take a special interest in cannibalism because it is so deviant, and it is something that has popped into my head in my earlier days. I have gotten a handle on it now. But, so that's one of the reasons I took a certain interest in him. It just through serendipity or whatever, it was some dark serendipity, whatever you want to call it, that we ended up meeting up the way we did. I mean, again, I was not approaching him. I'm not a serial killer groupie. More or less, I'm trying to understand who and what I am. And, again, it just so happened that we ended up developing a relationship, and he, again, initiated contact. So I don't know what that says about my character, but whatever, that's the way it is. I don't know if that answers all your questions or fleshes everything out properly, but just let me know.
The thing is,
I'll work with you.
A journalist normally would set up a relationship between the subject, say, with Arthur. In this particular case, because he had approached you and because of the business arrangement of you helping to sell his artwork and you being a fan, obviously, of his artwork, and that relationship seemed to work well, and he trusted you. He had a lot of trust issues with other people thought that might want to rip him off or had not been totally honest in the past. So he appreciated that. Now, on that level, for to be able to relate to him, other than the appreciation of the artwork and the ability to give him some money that he wanted in this for the work that he did, how did you relate to him? In what way? Give us some examples of the type of conversations in the very beginning that you two, like you say, you met somebody finally you could relate to. Let's have that kind of conversation that you two related to.
Well, and I'll add that he trusted me enough to have me work with him on his autobiography, you know, so I was writing that with him for a while, and that fell apart. It's obviously a bizarre situation, so it's like to get to figure out who I am and what this is all about, why people think this way. It's like Bruce Lee says, you can't learn to swim on dry land. So I can't go to the average psychologist or therapist and, you know, they'll lock you up. I mean, if you talk about certain things. So I went right to the source. Like, why do I have similar thoughts, in a sense, as far as, you know, not to hurt necessarily innocent people, but, you know, you have these thoughts like a whirlwind going through your mind. And it just so happened, again, we came across each other. The conversations, they could get fairly intense and perverse. He was rather crude when it came to the subject of women, and I don't think that way about women, but he did. And, so, you know, you just try to find a happy medium. I don't know if it's a happy medium, but it's a contented medium. I don't know. It's so beyond bizarre to most people. It's difficult to explain, but I don't know. Again, do you want to know anything specifically in this regard? The conversations went anywhere from cannibalism to you know, victims he strangled to death. I mean, again, it's not something I glorify at all. I'm just what's happening with me, and I don't know why we formed this friendship. It is, you know, apparently there's some spiritual connection there that I have yet to entirely understand.
Let's talk about the actual agreement that you came to, and you can maybe tell us. At what point in the relationship, how long from the beginning of this relationship that this agreement came into fruition, and that did you guys start talking about this biography, this story about his whole life? And also, what did he promise in this? Later we'll talk about the 60,000 words that he had written, but what did he purport to, what did he promise you that it would contain in there? What's the kind of things that he said that would be included in this? That he would provide to you?
Supposed atrocities he had committed in Vietnam, for instance, things like that. The possibility that he had some involvement with a couple of Jehovah's Witnesses, whether that was true or not, you know, certain things he said I took with a grain of salt, you know, so you don't know what to take seriously or not, but he was promising to reveal certain aspects of his childhood, and to expound upon the molestations or alleged molestations, however you want to look at that, and you know, just to get deeper and darker than most of the other books have. You know, he hated certain authors who had written about him. You know, he was venomous about various psychologists and authors. So he wanted to tell his story strictly from his side of the street, so to speak. And he assured me that, and he also assured me that once this deal went through, in his words, that we would be brothers, quote unquote. You know what that means? I'm not entirely certain of that either. But I have some idea. It's a very demonic connection. I mean, again, it's hard to relate to most people with this type of thing. But that's the extent. That's about that sums it up. I think it sums it up. I mean, I don't know if I'm entirely answering. The question, and I want to work with you here, so you could direct me. All right. Okay.
Now, involved in all of this too is that is the role of alcohol and drugs, and some of your demons that you had personally in your life. And you talk about that Arthur Shawcross was a father figure, and you had a father, I believe, a stepfather, at least two other role models, father figures in your life, and you said, I could relate more so to Arthur Shawcross. Now, I know that there is some, I don't know, it's not a sense of humor, but I don't know exactly what to take absolutely serious from you as well. Tell us what you think about this. Again, the father figure, why?
It's a funny thing. I consider myself as having had three fathers, you know, my biological father, I call him my bio-illogical father, and my uncle, who was my surrogate father, and they're brutal men. I mean, I've been surrounded by brutal men that you know, forced me into a situation where I had to defend myself, and I had to become brutal myself in my own right against bullies, you know, just, but Shawcross came along, and there was that, there was a sense of connection where it's this goes to show you how brutal and horrible these other men were, I guess, you know, where this felt like a gentler relationship than what I had with my biological father and my surrogate father there. And so I consider him father number three in a sense. And again, I know it's out there and bizarre, but it's all I had. You know, I don't have a lot of connection with humanity. And out of the three fathers I've had, my quote unquote, he was actually, this is an awful thing to say maybe, but he was, I guess, the most understanding, we'll say. I mean, that's my view of that. I mean, again, I'll talk more about that if you want. But I do have a dark sense of humor. I do add that into the book, and that's true. You know, I try to lighten things up a little bit. But at the same time, you know, I considered him a connection. You know, we were connected somehow. Again, it was a dark connection, but it was real. But, you know, so I'm not exaggerating there at all.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, Brian, before you did this, how much did you know, or how much research did you do at all about Arthur Shawcross and his crimes? Not that it's necessary, but how much did you do? And also, what were your first thoughts when you first saw some of the contents of this Shawcross correspondence with John Paul Fay?
I was, to answer the latter part first, I was pretty blown away. The letters are, John's writing is very strong. The letters, though, also are unique. I mean, I've read books before. I read a book a long time ago called Lustmord, The Writing and Artifacts of Serial Killers, years ago, which is a good book. And there's a lot of very unique writings in there. But these letters, I think a lot of them top anything I've read, in part because they bounce back and forth between absolute brutality and then him jumping back to talking about like some recipe of peanut butter ping pong balls or something.
And
it's, so I was pretty blown away by the letters. As far as how much I knew about Shawcross, I did not know. I'm not somebody I would classify myself as a, I mean, I've read a lot. I've probably read, if I were to guess, I've probably read 200 or 300 true crime books, but I read a lot anyway. So, I mean, I am a fan of true crime. I knew who Shawcross was. I was not a total expert on Shawcross, even though when you said, well, you said earlier when we were chatting that there wasn't much information on Shawcross itself, and I did that on purpose because, to me, the book isn't actually about, it's about his writings, it's about his thoughts, but I made a conscious choice not to write a long biography of him, because that to me wasn't the entire point of the book, was to go back over what he had done already. And he does that enough himself in the letters.
Sure.
He does get in a lot of detail about what he did. You know, he's a unique character. I mean, I read a lot about him that he had a very low IQ. But then you can tell, I also read other places that he had an average IQ. There's a lot of different information that you find on him, but you can tell he's not stupid by his letters. And he also the way that he definitely glorifies what he did to John, which is why I think it's important that you say that earlier, that the book isn't about glorifying this person. The book's just about honesty. You know, it's just about showing. That's kind of what I was getting at earlier, where so many people might act that if you don't read somebody's writings or words, then, you know, they don't exist or the person doesn't exist. But these people do exist. I'm not talking these people like John. I'm saying these people like Shawcross, they do exist. And it's jarring to read his letters, I would say, even for somebody like myself, who's pretty, I would say, very bomb-proof compared to the average person.
Yeah, sure. Certainly. Now, John, you talked about what Arthur Shawcross, you talked about, you just mentioned the deal that fell through. So we talked about the deal and some of the things he promised to hold nothing back and to provide everything, he said, without anything specific. He just said, I'll give you everything. And he talked about a 50-50 split. So he did value what he thought you were doing on his behalf, but he did really think, and I could see where he thought this maybe 10 years ago before the big crash in 2008, that there might be a $50,000 advance. Now you, however, talked to publishers as you were to approach agents, and what did the agents tell you? And then how is that important in this deal falling through with Shawcross?
Well, I got a literary agent very quickly, actually, with the subject matter. And the agent had had a lunch with a particular publisher, true crime publisher, and this publisher figured the market was oversaturated at the time with Shawcross material, believe it or not. But didn't mean the thing was over. I mean, you know, you keep working, you keep trying. But so I sent that information over to Shawcross, and he is not as understanding as your average person. I mean, you know, you got to consider the source, and you know. But so he wasn't holding it against me, but he was disappointed, and he kind of lost interest in the whole thing. I think he was depressed over it, quite frankly. But again, I mean, I never gave up on it. I still picked up on the project, you know, several years later. I put a different spin on it and that type of thing. But if he had stuck with me, we might have broken through. You know, it's just that's how he was. You know, that's how Shawcross was. You know, so I understand it. It was frustrating for me at the time too, just dealing with him. I understood the publisher's side. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, that's what happens when you're dealing with a convicted serial killer cannibal. I mean, such is life.
But he also thought that it was unusual that you would have to provide the entire manuscript. And again, combined with his paranoia about being ripped off, he still thought, and again, not every nonfiction true crime proposal demands that the entire manuscript be sent beforehand. No. So not that he would know that, but I would say that that's what he thought, that it was unusual. And he really did have this sense that he was disappointed with you, not that he didn't trust you, but he didn't trust anybody else. He didn't trust you handing over the manuscript to somebody else.
Exactly. And I don't blame him. I don't blame him, to be truthful. But see, there was a trust issue with the publisher in Shawcross, you know, and again, dealing with a convicted mass criminal, you know, that's what I think it's paranoia on the publisher's part, to be honest with you. But that's just the way it worked out. I mean, and Shawcross didn't have a lot of leeway for disappointment, but I have no regrets. I think it worked out for the best, truthfully.
Now, let's talk about, as you do, what this does for you. This correspondence that you can't share with anyone else. Now you have these fantasies and these urges, this sense of humor that no one can understand. You've got trouble in your life, in your personal life. But what does the correspondence do for you personally? Does it help you? Does it hurt you? What does it do for you? And does that change?
I think it offers me a sense of support. At least, I mean, that's how twisted my own life is, or has been. I'm trying to get things in order nowadays, but still, nothing's perfect. It has given me a sense of connection, you know. And again, I don't support his actions. You know, necessarily, but it gives you a sense that somebody is out there. You know, somebody's out there and they're listening to you. You know, because I am such an isolated person. You know, so it's rare for me to connect like that. So that's what it is. It's mostly about connection and having some sense of, I guess, brotherhood, if you want to call it that. Maybe I'm using the term inappropriately. I know. But
You talked about a ghoulish brotherhood and and hellish charisma.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's some of the language you're using is very provocative and also very interesting. How you're trying to, again, I know it's difficult to try to describe this for us.
It is.
I wanted to also ask you that. To try to understand this too, because you have this Murderbilia site, And you also have a fascination yourself. It's not just to sell everything. You are also a collector. So tell us the kinds of things that you collected and you found interesting and that Arthur also found interesting.
Right, yeah. No, I've lost interest in selling things. I'm more the collector. You know, I've always been more the collector. I mean, my thing has usually been, say, shrunken heads, you know, sideshow gaps or just sideshow attractions. So that's something we definitely shared an interest in. I think he was fascinated that I was fascinated by that because he hadn't even gone to that level. And, you know, I spent years collecting shrunken heads and that type of thing. And, you know, there's a lot of people who pretend or think they're hard or whatever into horror and bizarre things. But once you show them your collection of shrunken heads, they shrink away, so to speak. And, you know, you don't keep many friends. So the only friends I could have were people like Shawcross, and, you know, that's it. You know, so I'm looking to actually rebuild that collection, believe it or not. I've sold them, and that's what I do. I sell and I rebuy my whole life. But, I would say that's the most bizarre or interesting artifact that I collect. I think that's a height of bizarre, shrunken human heads, in my opinion. But that's just what that's what I'm into.
Yeah. I think though, if I could jump in really quick, just because I was listening to John's answer there, and I think one of the most interesting aspects of the book is that John's really an extremely dark guy. I mean, he's a really dark guy, and when you ask that question of you know, embracing someone, brotherhood or whatever, there's a distinct theme throughout the book that the further John went into this relationship with Shawcross and the further he indulged his darkness, the more his life was falling apart. And I think that's it's not a moralistic book in any way, shape or form, but there's definitely a thread throughout the entire book of John, you know, being like, I'm dark. I got darker. It wasn't working out, you know? And I think that's an interesting part of the book as well. It goes along with that brotherhood aspect of it.
Mm-hmm. With this, John, when I mentioned the idea that in 2003 it became known, or at least Shawcross talked about cannibalism officially for the first time after confessing to murder, but now apparently confessing to cannibalism, you said you've read all the material.
Yeah.
How much do you
Everything
believe
available.
That he was a cannibal, and or what did you share a fantasy more so?
I know what you're saying. My gut tells me that he most likely did indulge in some cannibalism. That's just a feeling I get from him.
Right.
Knowing how things progress for killers, things get stranger and stranger. That's no surprise at all. I mean, for me, if you research this enough, and I know you have, and Brian has certainly. I have no doubt that he indulged in that. And you know, that's been a major interest for me. It's never been a sexual thing for me. There's a lot of these guys who do it for sexual reasons, but that has not been the drive in my own mind. You know, when I was at my worst between 15 and 25, sex, it was really the whole cannibalism aspect, to be quite truthful with you. And that's what this book is about, too. It's about honesty and confession. You know, I'm getting this out of my system, more or less, you know, so... And again, feel free to ask any questions in this regard. Unusual.
How close did you come to acting upon your urges? And the correspondence with Shawcross influenced you in what way in that regard?
First of all, felt with Shawcross that you had a backer, again, somebody who understood me and would understand me. He would always say, be good or be good at it, you know, and hinting that he knew about my my way of thinking. And as to how close I've come, I've come uncomfortably close, to put it that way. Point in 2001, you know, walking the streets hoping to come across this prostitute I knew was around. Thank God I didn't come across her at the time. Again, I've worked it out of my system since in a positive way. But, I've come very close. I've had friends shackled in my apartment before. You know, it's Again, thankfully, nobody was killed. But things like that. It's gotten about as bizarre as you would get, just short of killing anybody. But, you know, again, the sexual thing was never my issue. So, but it's even weirder than that, I mean, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. Again, you know.
What I found odd, and not everyone would know, but I know from a case I was involved in that this was similar, in that Shawcross tells you, listen, when we talk on the telephone, they can be listening in, but when they're, we can write different stuff in letters. So that's the better way to communicate is through the letters.
Yeah,
now, you talk
true.
About some of the content of those letters, and like Brian had said too, it's the one of the most odd things is the evident narcissism where and psychopathy that where he talks about something very, very serious about one of his victims and doing horrendous things to that person, and then goes and switches right in the next sentence to something like, I gotta go make a sandwich. So
yeah.
But some
yeah.
of the content it doesn't look like it was so, at least the vast majority, it didn't look like it was ever incriminating to him for further charges or anything.
Right.
Tell us a
yeah,
little bit
yeah.
about some of the content. We established that some's not serious. He talks about Osama bin Laden. He talks about 9/11. But in terms of murder and cannibalism and things that this audience might be interested in, what is some of the content in those letters that he shares with you?
Well, I mean, it's evident that he has an affinity for cannibalism himself. And again, he hinted at certain things that he did that he had not been convicted of. Apparently, the FBI and the police believe that he might be responsible for at least 19 killings as opposed to the 12 that he was convicted of. And he told me that he'd done many more than that, whether that included what he did in Vietnam, I don't know. But he kind of boasted about his proclivity to cannibalize. I mean, that was the main thing. To me, that was central. I guess that's what sticks in my mind. I don't know if you're going to ask something else. Sorry.
He would run down victim lists as well. He would roll through, like, the people. That,
oh, right.
He would go by, like, the color of hair and, you know, what he did to them. And
yeah, exactly.
And lots of detail around the actual, not total detail, but just alluding to things that he had done.
He liked to tease a bit with that type of subject matter.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah. So
he did
provide details.
He did provide details though that sort of seemed when you would send him photo again. Tell us what you sent him that he would comment on. I found this very interesting. You did send him regularly some things, and he would comment them. Tell us a little bit about that exchange.
Well, again, I would send him photographs of the shrunken heads and shrunken bodies, too, that I would come across online. And also certain these strange, come across these death scenes, you know, on the Internet that I would be able to mail him once in a while. And he would have some commentary on that, you know, so that type of deal. And I don't know, it was such a strange Twilight Zone type relationship, and we had a very dark sense of humor about these things. It sounds awful to say, and it's not that I take what he did to some of those victims, certainly or any of them, but again, it was an extraordinarily bizarre, macabre sense of humor to an extent. I mean, it's not that I was getting off on the death photos or anything. It was just, two maniacs amusing each other. I mean, that's what it boiled down to.
Right.
You know, so I don't know if that answers anything that you asked.
Sure.
Okay.
Brian, you also were involved in reading this, obviously, and intimately involved in this entire book. How interesting did you find it that Arthur Shawcross, in real time, was reading something like Silence of the Lambs and Hannibal? And, you know, we're not
right.
So long after Jeffrey Dahmer, which would, you know, real life, not fictional, was at the same time. What do you think of some of his observations about things that are going on in Hollywood concerning cannibals?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I didn't think of it quite that way because it was obvious that he because of his own stuff, I would think it would make sense that he would have a little bit of a vibe of like wondering what Dahmer was up to. But that was like a lot of his letters. The things that I found the most interesting, like at one point, I don't know if you picked up on this, Dan, but at one point he was going on about Nico Clow, who was the vampire of Paris. And he kind of did this big long thing about how Nico was trying to, and I've actually, believe it or not, I've interviewed Nico Clow for another project I was working on it at one point. But to me, the mundane aspects, as I was saying before, of his letters were just as fascinating, just to see not just what, you know, a person in prison for the rest of his life thinks, but he was so they vacillated, like you said, like on a split second between just going through this horrific list of something that something like me, like I said, who I'm not at all like the kind of person that would get freaked out by something like this. And I'm like, whoa, this guy is like out of his mind. And then you just switch right back over to just talking about something, just some regular sort of thing that was going on in jail or him working out or so on and so forth. And the letters themselves, I think would have made for a really interesting document, even without all the great work that John put into it.
Thank you, by the way.
Oh yeah,
he called you the Saw Man with your eBay handle, but there was quite a bit of a friendship. You talk about this relationship as a friendship, and you talk about the surrogate father and father figure. And so a lot of these letters are very kind of upbeat and supportive and friendly, and he doesn't really doesn't exhibit some of the, I guess, what we might think is the character of a serial killer in trying to dominate you or order you around. It really is, seems like, a friendship of sorts.
Yeah, it was a kinship, I guess we could call it, a dark kinship. Yeah. Yeah, Sawman was my handle on eBay for a while, and he really took a liking to that. So, but yeah, I mean, there was never any situation where I felt where he was overbearing or anything. It really was, like you say, a friendship. And again, it's out there for most people, but that's the way it is. I mean, I don't know what else to say. Thankfully, I have ability to write, so I could channel my energies into my writing. But, I mean, if I didn't have that, I don't know which direction I would have went myself, truth be told. I mean, if you want to get candid about it, you know, I could have been the heterosexual version of Jeffrey Dahmer. I mean, that's the way I see it. Scary, but true.
And you had a fascination with Jeffrey Dahmer, as did, a lot of people, but Shawcross as well.
Yeah.
Tell us again, because he had an interest in heads, maybe not shrunken, but keeping heads. So what was the fascination with Jeffrey Dahmer that you shared?
It's funny. He came around in 1991, just as I was starting to develop my own mentality in the same area, I guess. There's a, call it a synchronicity or whatever it is. But he was into the same things that I was developing an interest in at that time, in 1991, when I was 15. You know, and it's just like Ed Gein. I'm into the weirder side of this type of deal. You know, again, it's not a sexual thing. It's more about being a collector, collecting people or parts of them. For Jeffrey Dahmer, the head was the pinnacle of the person that represented their spirit and everything that they had. And so I could relate to that. I don't know why I can relate to that, but I do. And, you know, but
you,
yeah,
also,
and
sorry, Brian talked about Nico Claus, and you also had a correspondence with him as well, this vampire Paris.
I did. Yeah, I did.
Very interesting and, how you communicated with him in prison, then out of prison as well, if I'm not correct.
Yeah.
What kind of correspondence, what was the gist of that correspondence with him?
That was definitely mostly related to business and the artwork he was doing. And there was certain artwork I wanted him to do in prison that they wouldn't allow him to do in prison. But once he got out of prison, he was able to do that. I was selling his art for a while. I don't even, again, it was two groupies that he and I came into contact with. It's a dark serendipity. I mean, it's a demonic situation. Again, I'm trying to make peace with it.
He still sells his artwork. He's very active in that world.
Absolutely.
So.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, that's true. That's true. I mean, it's a very strange underground, but it exists.
Tell us about the subject of his artwork.
Well, that's interesting. He would do other serial killers oftentimes. Like, I had several of his paintings that he did of Jeffrey Dahmer and Gacy and Shawcross, too. You know, and
he got involved with the guys that do Serial Killer Calendar, like, ended up. That's all Nico's artwork. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, yeah.
What about the Shawcross? What was the subject matter, again, ironically?
Yeah. Shawcross generally did fairly mundane, unless I asked him to do something else. He would do ducks and birds, but I wanted him to do something a little more bizarre, and that's how I ended up with Grandpa Ghoul. I don't know if you've seen that drawing at all.
Yeah.
But it's like an Albert Fish character holding a human head. So I actually requested him do something a little more interesting, and which he did. So that's why I'm hesitant to give that one up. Yeah.
Now there was a change in the laws called the Freedom of Expression. How does that change your relationship, if at all? Tell us about the Freedom of Expression and your conversations with Shawcross about that.
Again, it was such a gray area. I mean, it allowed us some more leeway, to put it that way. We had some more leeway. But other than that, I mean, I don't think it affected anything too much. I mean, I'm vaguely aware of it, like, as a peripheral deal. But, it just gives you a little more room to move, a little more breathing room. That's all. If that makes sense.
Provided for a good percentage, I think it's half the percentage of the profit to go to a victim's fund, didn't he?
Right. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Yes, that's true. Yeah, anyway. Right.
Now, at some point,
he wasn't always,
this... Go ahead, sorry.
No, he wasn't always happy about that, but, I mean, he did what he had to do, obviously. I mean, you know, I guess it's the least he could do, needless to say. But anyway, I thought I'd add that.
Brian, when you talked about reading this manuscript from John, what were your thoughts about, it seemed like at while John Paul is unraveling, it seems that Arthur Shawcross is experiencing some health problems and also this problem of getting out this book that he wanted so badly to have published from John Paul.
Right.
That seemed to be unraveling in terms of the communication between them and the agreement between them. What did you think about that, those two scenarios at the same time, the unraveling and the unraveling of the deal?
Well, I mean, as I said before, I mean, obviously I don't have a problem with things getting really dark. And one of the things I like the most about this book is I think it's a really, really brave book. I don't think there's a lot of books quite like it. At the same point, I've had my share of things in my own personal life that I've had to deal with. And you know, if you want to embrace the darkest side of you, it's pretty much never going to work out. You know, it's pretty much never going to work out in this society, in the society we live in. So I thought that the book does a really good job at drawing that line, where you see Shawcross kind of gets a little more delusional as it goes on, in my opinion, with the book. I obviously work as a writer, so I get this maybe more than most people would, but his concept of, if I let anything out, people are going to steal my ideas kind of thing. I mean, I've dealt with that before. And when I deal with somebody like that, I usually try to get away from that person as soon as, as soon as possible. And at the same point, John, you know, who does have this brotherhood father figure, is, you know, because he sort of has these letters and these thoughts, and they're being reinforced by somebody who's kind of going further and further down the further and further down the rabbit hole. And so I think that the duality of that really focuses the book in into what it is, which is again, not just the story of dark people doing horrible things, but there is a kernel of hope there in certain ways as well, as far as where Shawcross wound up and where John is now, are two very different places.
Right. John, in your personal life, I asked Brian about it, but in your personal life, what was happening, and did you have that rock bottom moment, something, an event that was a catalyst for change? Tell us about that.
Rock bottom moment. I've had numerous rock bottom moments. Let's see. I guess finally, you know, eventually you alienate everybody around you. You know, when you're such a different personality, and you know, you learn not to deal with bullies, maybe as far as rolling over. And some of these bullies you had to depend on, but I would not have that. So I guess the rock bottom moment, the ultimate, would be living out in the woods of Wilmington, Massachusetts here in the in late fall, New England late fall. And I was by the train tracks, and literally every night while I was sleeping by the train tracks, I would just visualize myself, you know, myself stepping a few yards forward to step in front of the train and just ending it. But, you know, thankfully I never did, but I guess you want to go beyond that. I did hang myself. I mean, for what that's worth.
Yeah.
You know, and I survived that somehow. There was nobody to find me, but, you know, it's funny that I, you know, as a martial artist, and especially in jiu-jitsu, I specialize in chokes and strangulations, and, some reason I stuck around. I don't know why. I don't understand why. But, I ended up cutting myself down and moving on with my life. That's a very dark subject matter, but that's the truth. If you want to talk about rock bottom, there you go.
You talk about going to seeing a psychiatrist and then walking out on a psychiatrist, and then you talk about having restraining orders, and you talk about an ex-girlfriend that then speaks to the police. Tell us a little bit about some of the stuff where people in your life, again, have had enough, but there's restraining orders, but especially when the ex-girlfriend talks to the police, what does she say? Tell us a little bit about that situation.
Well, she tells them about my relationship with Arthur Shawcross, of course, and that didn't help matters. Generally, the police have been actually very cordial with me, but she just encountered me at my worst, especially when I was at the height of my drinking. I don't blame the drinking. I take responsibility, but I'm just saying. I was an extraordinarily scary person around her, and I don't blame her for leaving me. But, basically, like I say, the highlight of what she told the police was about my strange rants and my relationship with Arthur Shawcross, and how Arthur Shawcross wanted me, was asking me to kill people, basically. That's what she told the police, that Shawcross says I have to kill certain people, which was not entirely true. Oh, whatever. It doesn't bother me.
Okay, you say that was not entirely true. I was going to ask that question because it didn't seem like that he was commanding you, and you explained that it was certainly not an obligation or a command or a
right.
demand. But what was it?
No, exactly. No, it was just like a teasing hint. I mean, he would send me pictures of certain women who had screwed him over, you know, and it was a hint. But I don't think he actually expected me to go and kill anybody. I hope he didn't expect that. But he alluded to it. He gently alluded to it, but it was not a command, and I wouldn't have gone along with that anyway, you know. But yeah, so she read some of the letters. That's why she knew about that stuff. She was privy to some of the names.
Some of those letters.
Yeah, you know, when you get close to somebody, sometimes they can get a little too close, and you reveal a little too much. Or at least I have. And
right.
I probably should have never let her read those. She was I met her through my sister when my sister was in a psychiatric ward anyway, you know, so I've been in those wards myself, but I did meet her in a psychiatric ward. So that's whatever. I don't know. I don't put her down for that. I'm just saying, you know, I don't know if that answers anything what you asked me, but
when will you talk about the unraveling of this agreement? And finally, when you walked away, you say you tried to rekindle this, and you say in the book that you would have liked to rekindle the relationship and get the project going. So tell us about the circumstances that led to the dissolving of this agreement. Tell us about that.
Well, it's just that, as Shawcross said, he wasn't mad with me, you know. He was just disappointed. And in my mind, he kind of lost hope. That's a feeling I get. You know, that was his light at the end of the tunnel, the book, and he just lost hope. And that's just my sense. I really don't take that personally at all, but that's what happened. When the publisher stated that thought there was an oversaturation of Shawcross material, but he didn't understand, the publisher didn't understand what was going to be in this book. I think it was an ignorant decision, but there's nothing I could do about it. I was still going to move forward with it. You know. But sure, I mean, I'm dealing with a, you know, Arthur Shawcross type of character, so whatever. It gets it gets so bizarre, and it's difficult to convey. But yeah, I think he lost hope, you know, in the end. That's my feeling.
But you did walk away. You both said you both walked away from this project. But I mean, he was sitting there, so you were so frustrated with his attitude towards
exactly.
this and his non-comprehension of this that you just walked away. And when did it occur to you that you might still salvage it, or did you?
Yeah, we both gave up on each other. But again, about 10 years later, I decided to pick it up. I wasn't even sure if there was enough of a story there. But a family member was pushing me into it because I was looking for a project. And she said, look, there's a story here. People want to hear about your relationship with Arthur Shawcross. I wasn't certain. But eventually, it ended up working out for me, at least as far as getting a book contract and people interested. But I wasn't going to write it. I was not going to pursue this. It was just certain, again, family members pushed me into it, believe it or not. And my sister actually saved the Shawcross letters. Were it not for her, Jennifer, my parents, the demons that they are, would have thrown the letters out. I mean, they felt they were evil, in my mother's words.
Yeah.
You know.
Right.
Yeah. So it worked out for the best, I guess, if you, whatever, how you want to look at it. You know.
What about the 60,000 words? He mentions it many times. He has 60,000 words.
Yeah.
Now, is there any indication that he had that much done?
Yeah.
And
yeah. Yeah. He had a lot of pages of those. I used to have the pages. They've disappeared since. But, yeah, he gave me a lot of pages from that manuscript. So I believe that he had that. In my heart, I believe that he had that. He certainly had enough material. I know. You know. But he wasn't willing to give it up. You know.
And you could get, and you had the tone of what, you had basically the way he was going to present this, or the way he wanted to present his story, and his promise that he was going to provide everything. In the little bit that you saw, was that what you thought he was going to do?
Yeah, as far as what he was providing, he was doing everything according to plan. He and I were doing the right thing, you know. Again, he just didn't have the patience to wait. You know.
But when he says he's going to provide everything, that means he's going to clarify whether he was a cannibal.
Everything. Everything, yes. Everything, according to him. I really believe he was willing to confess every aspect of his crimes. You know, things he was not willing to talk about previously, and that he refused to talk about in certain interviews you may have seen on TV or wherever you've seen them. But, I believe he was going to give that stuff up. The darkest of his crimes. That's a sense I got.
Why did he want to convey everything? Why did you think that he wanted to do that? You talk about his health deteriorating later, but it's not like he thought he was on the verge of death. Why would he want to do it?
Well, I'll tell you. Money was a big thing with Shawcross, too, you know.
Right.
I think the financial impetus for his wanting to do that, truthfully. I mean, it boils down to that for a lot of situations. Nothing new there. So I just think he wanted to live a little bit more of a comfortable life while he was in Sullivan Correctional Facility. That's my opinion, anyway. You know.
Yeah, there's a thread. There's a thread throughout all those letters about money. I mean, even though he's in prison and he's never getting out, even from the very first letters, he's kind of like, John, like, you know, did you sell my stuff? I don't like people selling my stuff. I don't like people making money off of my stuff. And then, like, right to the end, he's like, well, I'm not going to give this away unless I get this much money. I mean, I think there's certain, whether someone's in prison or not, they're either wired to be, like, to be that way about money or they're not. And he definitely is obviously a narcissist, and he also wanted money. I mean, I think he thought that you know, he would be even more famous as opposed to infamous, and then he would make a lot of money. What he would do with it probably is irrelevant to a guy like that.
Well, I mean, it's commissary and whatnot. You live a little bit more comfortable.
Oh, no, life. I know. Yeah, no. No, and it's right. True. No, I know. Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
Absolutely. I know.
And there was times when he talked about being short on art supplies as well, which stopped the production of everything he was interested in doing, didn't it?
Yeah, I've contributed a little bit to myself for him. But even Nico Klo has contributed to that, you know, so several people have. But yeah, he had talked about that numerous times. Shortage of art supplies, you know. But
Brian, how surprised were you the fan mail and the groupies and the offers for people to marry him? What did you think of that correspondence?
Honestly, that doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, there's been so many serial killers that have been married while they're in prison, you know, and there's, I mean, I wrote an article one time about serial killers that were married in prison. I mean, there's just a lot of people that have, I mean, it's difficult to explain. I'm not even trying to explain it, but I mean, there's a lot of people that they want to know something like that, and they want to touch something like that. And I think, like, Richard Ramirez, like, he used to get, I mean, I don't even, Manson, guys like that, they'd get dozens of letters a day, you know. I think it's just I think a lot of people don't know about it, but I think it's a pretty common thing. I'm working with the mother of Luca Magnotta right now on a book, and she's telling me how much mail he gets every day.
Sure.
I think it's a pretty common thing.
Yeah, incredible. Yeah. Now, we talk about, you mentioned that the official count is, I see 13, then I see 14 murders. I've seen 12. But now you talk about the authorities thinking he might be, you know, suspected of other murders.
At least 19.
Did the authorities, did you ever come in contact with the authorities? We talked about your girlfriend saying something to the police, but you said the police weren't that interested in what she said.
No.
But was there any instance where, because of this correspondence or because of who you were, or especially because of this correspondence, you came to the attention of authorities?
You know, the funny thing is, for whatever reason, the police and judges have been on my side so far, so I don't understand that myself, but that's been the case. And so I've avoided bad situations. I've been in bad situations, but the situation could have been a lot worse. I think it's about, as they say, being a gentleman and just being human to each other. But, yeah, nobody ever dug into the Shawcross letters too much or, you know, what he claimed to have done, you know. And I never projected that to them, you know, obviously. So I don't know what to say beyond that. I mean, was he exaggerating with certain things he told me about, say, Jehovah's Witnesses he supposedly murdered? I have no idea. I took that with a grain of salt. He only mentioned the Jehovah's Witnesses after I mentioned Jehovah's Witnesses, that I found them to be interesting people just coming on a stranger's doorstep, you know. So whether that's true or not, I didn't go to the police with that. I mean, I just took it with a grain of salt again, you know. I think he was saying it to impress me, to be honest with you. That's my perception.
Was there anything in I know that you didn't see the 60,000 words completely, but was there seemed right. to be any issues of the murders or of the confessions that now he was going to reveal and clear up? Were there any issues or things that he wanted to address in this, again, final manuscript, this biography of his life?
I mean, that's the sense I got, that he was supposed to reveal everything, you know. And finally, that was the whole point of this, you know. That's why there's so much disappointment, you know. Because apparently, again, the publisher didn't quite understand. Shawcross wasn't just going to be talking about what everybody else was talking about. He was going to be delving a lot deeper than that. So, I don't know. I mean, basically, yeah, I believe he was going to reveal a lot more of what he has done. And I'm particularly interested in what he did in Vietnam, actually, believe it or not. Because apparently he went wild with his cannibalistic tendencies over there. And again, my heart tells me that there's some truth to that, at least. I don't know how much truth, but there's some truth to that. Yeah. So however you want to view that, up to you.
With this, I'm just curious, with this publisher, you did say that Arthur sent you certain things, certain material. Couldn't you cobble enough material that was unique, at least a chapter, and give it to this publisher? I don't understand why he couldn't understand the potential of what this guy might say.
I don't understand either. I'm on the same exact page with you, because I did send him at least one or two chapters of what the, after I cleaned it up and everything, I sent it to the publisher, and he still wanted to see the entire manuscript. So he didn't, you know, that's the way it went. But I don't understand it either. I'm with you on that. Totally with you.
What was contained in those sample chapters? Give us a description of the gist of what was contained in there.
His childhood and how his mother molested him, and how she performed oral sex on him, and all this other stuff that, you know, that it warped his mind, or at least played a role in warping his mind. Whether you're born with that and certain things facilitate that further, I have no idea. But he was admitting to or opening up about his mother's molestation of him and that type of thing. And I think that's a major thing. I think that warps a child. I mean, certainly. I've been around, you know, people like that throughout my entire life, sexual deviants, you know. So I understand it. I can assure you of that.
If it were true, certainly. Is there anything, though, that a publisher, to be fair, the publisher might have wanted something that could be substantiated, corroborated?
Right. Yeah.
And also something more pertinent to, again, those issues that were left unresolved. Again, cannibalism of the boy in 72, quite a revelation in 2003.
Yeah,
did you get a sense that he was going to come clean on the cannibalism and specifically which victims? Like, he mentioned the three girls. He mentioned the two women in two girls in Vietnam, and then he mentioned the boy in another. So do you think he was going to come clean, be specific, and say, admit to everything in that correspondence?
I mean, in my mind, that was the unspoken understanding. That's a sense I got, that he was opening up with this. That was, again, the whole point of this. I believe he was going to go that direction. I do feel that. And what he told me personally, with piecing this thing together, all of his crimes throughout the years, and I really believe this is going to be the pinnacle of what he had to say, you know. From my perspective, you know, that's the way I see it. And that's my honest perspective.
Let me ask either one of you, after he died, what about the 60,000 word, this manuscript? Did you look into it? Did anyone look into the existence of it, or the who could take possession of it? Or
yeah, it's a good question, whether that goes to his family or whether they just come in and throw everything away. I honestly don't know. I really don't. I never heard of anything about it since.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who knows? I mean, who knows what happened in prison? I mean, a lot of strange things happen in prison.
Yeah, that would be almost impossible for somebody to get their hands on something like that wasn't direct family once. I mean, it would be possible that maybe if someone in his family got it, that they could have reached out to John or whatever, but that's such a yeah, you, they have such control over everything in those situations. It's
exactly
who knows what
exactly
happened to it, you know?
Right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah, I have some jail experience myself, and it's very locked down, you know, very locked down. So such is life, I like to say.
Now, with this, with these, again, these urges, and you said you've worked through, obviously you've never acted upon any of these urges or fantasies or desires. You've had this experience with Arthur Shawcross, who you firmly believe definitely acted upon it, upon these urges, and much, much more, and then reveled in it. You enjoyed that camaraderie, that you could at least relate to him and reveal to him these desires, which you said were a no-no anytime you even thought of conveying it to anyone else, revealing this information to anyone else.
Yeah, of course. I mean, again, with, even the therapist said, yeah, go on, sorry.
How do you work through this? What is the process that you come to terms with these urges, and as we can evidence today with this book and with you appearing on this program, you're not isolated and without people in your life. So how did, what's the process that you use to, and how did you come out of this?
Well, again, the writing is a major part of it. You know, I get to channel that energy into my writing. I'm grateful for that. But also, you know, I've had a lot of, I've sought help. You know, I actually have therapists and psychiatrists and things like that. And it's a maturing too, I realized. Maturity, where you realize you don't want to hurt people. You know what I mean? You don't want to hurt anybody. And so you try to work that out for yourself. You know, you get yourself in order. Because it's not very polite to go around cutting people's heads off. I don't know. Maybe that's my perception of things. You know, so you start to realize this. And, yeah, it's definitely a maturing. So, yeah, so I do that. I talk to therapists, and I have a good friend. I have a decent friend, actually. She's my auntie wife, I call her. We have all the normal stuff you would have in a relationship except the physical stuff, of course. You know, that's how I get screwed over. But, yeah, the auntie wife. So I have her to talk to. Things like that. It's just about connection. You got to connect with humanity on some level. And so I've worked to do that, and I've managed it. So far, so good, you know, I think, you know. Man, life is unpredictable, though. You know, life is very unpredictable. I don't know what else to say beyond that. It's a strange life.
Brian.
Strange life.
Brian, you have the beginnings of the promotion for this book. Maybe you can tell us when this book comes out officially. But also, you are beginning to experience some of the, again, I apologize, but you're going to get some strange questions and demand some kind of maybe unexplained answer. But you're just beginning to do this, but you know that you're prepared for very interesting questionnaires and interviews about this book, don't you?
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And thanks for having us. I wasn't wanted to say it. Thanks for having us on, because I know it's a very dark book. I used to just briefly, but you know, I'm a fairly weird guy myself. But I've always been. I used to work as a prisoner advocate for the ACLU. So when I was younger, I used to go into prisons and I would meet with people that had done certain things. And I've always been an extremely, extremely non-judgmental person. You know, that's sort of like why I do this kind of work for the most part, I think. And I'm more than ready for it. I mean, it's the kind of thing. And again, you know, you had me on when we were with Gil, you know, the so-called cannibal cop, where a man went to prison for like almost 2 years,
yeah.
because he was so weird. That like people were like, he has to be in prison because he's so weird, you know. So I'm more than happy to you know, to be working on this book with John and to answer any sort of questions about, you know, because the conversation is important, really. I mean, when it just even just what I said, you know, the fact that people get so, you know, there's all sorts of different people around, and some of them are way weirder than we know. And it doesn't help to just pretend the situation doesn't exist and ostracize people. That's for sure. So the book comes out on the 13th, which is right around the corner, just next week. I think we've got some pretty good think we've got some pretty good press lined up. We'll see. It's hard to tell with a book of this nature because of exactly what you just said. Even when you're promoting it, it's a fascinating book. I think it's going to sell. I really think it's going to sell pretty well. But at the same point, there's going to be certain media outlets that are going to be like, oh my God, you know, like I don't want to talk about this stuff, and that's okay, you know.
Wow, they got to grow a soul, Brian. They got to grow a soul.
I think you're going to have interviews. I just think you're going to have. I think you're going to have questions that. I think you're going to have some really hard to answer questions because I think this is
right.
Again, if people take the time to read the entire book, then of course you have a much better idea of how this can work, and you have a different perspective on this entire story. Without that, if you look at a headline or you think, or if you imagine without knowing, then that's much different.
I get your point.
Mm-hmm. The
sorry, Dan, go ahead.
No, sorry. The journey for you, John Paul, with these letters, you say you were disappointed that this project went awry. What about when this person that you had a friendship, did you call the surrogate father? What was your response when he died in prison?
In a way, to be honest with you, it's relief because, you know, you have a 250-year sentence. To me, it's a relief. It's a relief and a release. So it's not that I felt a sadness necessarily. Just I'm relieved for Shawcross in that sense, that he's at least out of here, you know, out of prison. And, you know, I mean, that's the best I could say. And sometimes I have a reptilian view of humanity, and I apologize for that. But in this case, I did have a connection with him, and I did feel a certain degree of relief for him when he died in 2008. That's just how I feel. Sorry if not everybody agrees with that. But
the sense of humor that you shared, the sense of humor that you shared, this macabre sense of, again, sense of humor,
right.
What are the things that you thought he was, dropped his guard and was very, again, father-like in some of the things that he talked about to you? What are some of those things that you thought were very fatherly and positive?
There was a sense where he was encouraging me to stay alive. I don't know if that comes through in the letters, but I got that sense where he you know, even tried to keep me from drinking, period. You know, because he was never a drinker himself, apparently. And, you know, it was that sense where he just wanted me to be alive. And, you know, and there was a darker element, like I mentioned earlier, where he said, be good at it. He kept saying that to me. So that was a confused message, I thought. I mean, so I didn't know which direction to go with that. I mean, my impression is he would have been okay if I went out and killed people or not. I mean, he was fine with it, and he would have been with me through the whole thing. It's very macabre. Take it from where it comes. This is what it is. You know, an extraordinarily dark story. It doesn't get much darker than this. Collecting human heads. I mean, how much darker did he get than that? It's, you know, I mean, what can I say? It is, that, look, I don't know why these thoughts came to me when I was 15, and suddenly thoughts of eating people came to me. I don't know where that comes from. I used to practice black magic when I was 10. My theory is this stuff came back to bite me, and because this thought patterns are straight from hell. Let's face it. I mean, that's how it is. But I think I got it under control now. I haven't eaten anybody yet, so I feel good about it. I'm all right. No worries. We're good.
There is one issue that goes that you talk about, and I, of course, I have to look into it. A mention of the boy Jack Blake. Was there any indication that he would come clean? And if so, what did he say to you to indicate that he would reveal something? What did he say to you about Jack Blake?
He was very vague. He mentioned Jack Blake. He mentioned Jack Blake, but he was very vague about the child. He was very vague about him. And we prefer not to talk about these earlier people. I mean, because me personally, I've always been into adults, people my own age, whether sexually or otherwise. So it was a very touchy subject matter, to say the least. And he wouldn't talk about this in interviews at all. But he did mention him to me. And my impression is he might have gone deeper into this subject if, you know, if the thing had unfolded the way it should have. Whatever. Again, we never discussed this in depth because I don't want to hear about his victims from the 70s before he was born, incidentally. I don't know what that says to you. It's a touchy subject matter for me, too. Yeah. Go on.
When he did talk, like, about the victims that he said he cannibalized, and so we do get that in the book that he says, these are the people that I cannibalized.
Yeah.
What does that do for you? I mean, obviously, before you got involved with this, you didn't correspond with cannibals. We have this Nico Clocks, but I mean, there must have been, and you talk about it, and what I'm trying to get to is you talk about this hell. You keep repeating the word hell and a different kind of evil and hell. But how do you tell us about this sort of precipice that you were on at some point where fantasy and sense of humor and sharing some of these urges, you're hearing something that is akin to incriminating evidence in a case potentially. Not that you're going to do anything, not that he's already in jail forever and ever anyway, but what does do to your psyche to have that knowledge and then not share that urge, that desire, like you said about the 10-year-old, how can you separate that? How do you separate that when it goes from fantasy to realization?
Yeah, in such another world, you don't talk to anybody about any of this. I mean, you walk in the streets with a plastic bag hoping to come across a prostitute you could decapitate and bring her head back home with you. Who do you talk to about that? You talk to another serial killer. I mean, you can't talk to your therapist about that. Psychiatrist, they'll have you locked up. I mean, that's the way that goes. So that's the truth. That was back in 2001, July. Thankfully, again, I've matured a bit since, quite a bit since then. I've come through a lot. But again, who do you talk to about that stuff? I mean, I that's why I could relate to Jeffrey Dahmer, you know, in a heterosexual sense. You know, I don't know why I have this understanding. It comes from a lifetime of abuse. I mean, I advise being abused for 15 years straight. And maybe you'll start to see things my way, but I don't know. It's dark and evil. That's the way it is. I'm in tune with these demons I'm trying to get out of my life. I mean, I'm riddled with demons, and I'm doing my best. You know, I'm doing my best. Again, at least I have the writing ability. You know, that's my main thing. That's my main focus, the writing. I'm sure a lot of writers can talk about something similar where they're haunted. You know, a lot of writers have committed suicide, Hunter Thompson, et cetera. They committed suicide. They were haunted, too. Maybe not as badly as I am, but still. So I'm just being honest with you. I don't know what this does to speak to my character, but I mean, it should speak to it in the sense that I'm fighting, and I have come this far. I've hanged myself and everything. Right. I've come back from death. You know, I've actually come back from death. So who could beat that, really? I mean, I'm being totally candid with you right now. I mean, yes, I've had similar thoughts since, again, 15, where I could have, and I passively stalked people out there, but I came back from it, thankfully, so far. I mean, Ed Gein didn't start killing until he was in his 50s, so anything could happen. I'm still in my early 40s.
Wow.
Let's hope I stay on the straight and narrow.
Wow.
Let's hope. That's why God invented prayer, I guess.
Sure, so. Certainly.
I don't mean to blow your mind.
You talk about
Jesus, John. I mean, I think quickly though that you know, even if he's saying who do you talk to about this stuff, I think that's what makes the book important. You know, I've tried to touch on that before, but I mean, that kind of conversation of somebody coming across this book and saying like, oh my God, I can't even believe that this guy
you know, wrote this, or maybe someone might listen to this and say, I can't believe you just said that. But at the same point, John's being honest, and he's being honest about what he thinks, somebody feels. And I mean, that's the beginning of, like, in all sorts of situations, of starting that conversation so people don't get hurt and people are okay and people can get help. And I think that's something that needs to be remembered when somebody reads a book of this nature, that it's not about glorifying. It's about trying to understand somebody that maybe before you read it was not understandable.
Well, that's why I think it is, like you said, it's brave. This book, as you say in the beginning of the book, is very brave, and it is very brave, John, to come on
extremely
and talk
brave
about these most intimate things that no one, and again, I've read a lot of stuff. Brian has read and been involved with a lot of stuff. This is a brave revelation because, again, you don't have a pat answer. You don't really have a pat answer, and it was an exploration. This book is an exploration of somebody that came very, very close, but again, close only counts in hand grenades and horseshoes. So, you know, the
right,
thing is,
right,
it's brave to discuss something like this. And also, it is fascinating to be able to have a cathartic effect from just, again, revealing these innermost, disturbing and disgusting thoughts and try to have people comprehend this for our understanding. Because people are very, very interested, very, very interested in the psychology of the aberrant mind. And you provide for that and try to work through for the reader how this could have happened and how it manifests itself with this correspondence, what the correspondence did for you, to you, what it did for Arthur Shawcross. It's a very, very fascinating, very fascinating book. I want to thank you very much, John Paul Fay and Brian Winnie, for coming on and talking about it. Now, this is
Dan, thanks so much. It's always a pleasure.
Well, thank you. It's fascinating, and I thank you for coming on and bringing to my attention this fascinating book. This is a Wild Blue Press release. Tell us a little bit about Facebook page or Wild Blue Press, how people might get this. Again, remind people when they can order this book. Tell us a little bit about how they might contact either one of you or get more information.
Sure. I have a website. It's brianwhitneyauthor.com. The book is out on Wild Blue, which is really, if people don't know, it's an excellent true crime publisher that just keeps putting out better stuff all the time. I mean, you can find them on Facebook, Twitter. They also have a website, and the book is out on the 13th. Again, it's up for pre-order right now. And John, I'm sure if anyone wanted to contact John right now, I don't know, John, if you have anything set up, but I would be glad to forward
it. No, they want to call me on the phone? They want to call me on the phone or what? I don't know.
Yeah, what's your phone number, John? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. We can I'd be glad to put anybody in touch with John that wants to be put in touch with John.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
You can find my information on my website, on my Amazon page. And Dan, again, thanks. It was a pleasure. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. This is fun. I like this. Very good.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. It has been a privilege and a great pleasure. Thank you very much for the Shawcross letters. John Paul Fay,
yes.
Brian Whitney.
Thank you.
You gentlemen have a great evening.
Hey,
okay,
you too.
You as well.
Thanks so much.
Okay.
Good night.